welcome to another episode of Fire My Belly, the only queer art podcast, TM. I am your host and also a homicidal maniac, Kat Graffam. In today's episode, I catch up with my good friend, Drew Riley. She's an incredible figure painter and a passionate community organizer and someone I admire immensely. She started a trans and intersex art festival called Gender Unbound in Austin, Texas, back in 2016, which I attended for 4 years in a row. And I have so many special memories from those events. Truly some of the best times of my life, honestly. If you'd like to see the video version of this podcast and get access to it 2 weeks in advance, go over to my Patreon at patreon.com/KatGraffam. Apologies for any weird audio in this episode. I had to hold my microphone because I've been having ongoing spinal issues and needed to be laying down in bed when I recorded this. I have surgery in a few days, so I'll probably have already had it by the time this goes out. And I hope to be getting back to normal again, finally. Anyway, here is the episode. Hello.
Hello. Oh my gosh, it's so good to see you.
I know, I was just about to say that. It's so nice to see your face.
It's been almost 5 years.
Yes, I was about to say the last time I saw you was in 2019.
Yeah, pre-pandemic.
I don't understand how that's possible, actually.
I don't either. It's weird. I feel like I lived two lives, like a pre-pandemic life and a post-pandemic life.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah. And it's like the last 4 years have just smushed all together. How are you doing? Are you in Seattle?
I am in, no, nothing that cool. I am in Eugene, Oregon.
Do you miss Texas?
That is a, yes, I do, honestly. But I also don't. It's a mixed bag.
Well, do you like Oregon?
I do like Oregon. I don't necessarily like Eugene. I have come to find my groove in it. I have come to find my people. But on the whole, Eugene is not my favorite.
What are you doing right now? Like, for work and life and everything?
It's very, again, I feel like I had like a pre-pandemic life and a post-pandemic life. Like, I don't do like, you know, pre-pandemic, I was fine artist, doing markets and tabling and then also executive directing Gender Unbound and doing all the festivals and hosting our own art markets. And
you did a whole lot of stuff.
And yeah, now I'm a UI UX artist on video games.
Really? Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's I design the user interface and the user experience in the games industry on a few, like, I work for a company that we like co-develop with other studios on their games. Mm-hmm. Mostly we've done like some of our own stuff, but like most of the work I've done is like that. So I'm on like different client projects, making stuff for their games.
I'm also working in games right now, which is kind of a weird pivot too.
What do you do in games?
Right now I'm working for a studio doing background painting.
Oh, awesome.
And it's, I mean, I don't think I can say too much about it, but it's very cool and could be.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be received very well.
I know what you mean by can't say much about it. Like, when you work in the games industry, there is a million NDAs. Every job you work on has an NDA. And so you're not allowed to talk much about it. which makes looking for work difficult sometimes, and talking to your friends about what you do annoying to them, because you're like always using coded language and mysterious things.
I feel like I'm in like the fucking CIA, like
yeah. I mean, I literally, granted, the company I work for, because they work for like a bunch of client stuff, they take security way more seriously than like I have at any other place I've worked. And because like if their client's data gets out, like they're in more trouble because they would lose the client work in addition to the leak, you know, like, and people wouldn't trust working with them and like all that stuff. So like the computer that I work on with them, like you can't plug in a thumb drive. You can't, like, I have like all this like multi-factor authentication stuff. I've got like, it's like the whole thing is locked down so tight. And like every time I log onto it, I've got like apps on my phone that I need to pull up so that I can verify that I'm logging into my computer and
dang,
all these things.
It's like you are in the CIA or the FBI.
It does. It's weird. It's weird. Yeah.
Did you do game stuff before painting?
Yeah, I did games before, doing like gender portraits and Gender Unbound. The school that I went to, when I went to art school, they kind of, a lot of their connections was in the games industry. Austin had like has a big games industry presence. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of studios there, especially like then, like in the early 2000s. I feel like there were even more. Or maybe that perception's off. I don't know. It felt like it. It felt like Austin was like booming and was going to be like the next huge games industry place. So a lot of their teachings, like in the first 2 years, you pretty much just learn like traditional technique. Mm-hmm. For like drawing and painting. And then in the last 2 years, you're kind of mixing in more digital mediums. And so a lot of that curriculum was geared towards like concept art and 3D modeling and stuff for video games. And so a lot of the internships people would get was in games. And that wasn't even really what I wanted necessarily to do as an artist. I was like actually really wanting to be more like a book, like illustrate. I wanted to like illustrate book covers and like children's books, and I wanted to do like magazine like editorial illustrations, and like I just wanted to.
That's the glamorous stuff.
Yeah, that's like I wanted to be in print media, and of course it's like the early 2000s as like Amazon is becoming a huge thing and e-readers are starting to come out and the internet like is starting to become the main publisher of news, and like it was like every headline around that time was like, this just in, print is dead.
Yeah.
And it was like I was watching my dreams crumble,
and it kind of I mean, it's not dead, but like it's certainly a lot harder to get work in that field, I would suspect, than before. I mean, I know that it's hard, but I'm imagining that it was probably not as hard in the past because there was just more availability. The school that you went to, we were just talking about this, was not an atelier, right? Which is, for listeners who don't know what an atelier is basically like you have one master painter and then like a bunch of students, and you essentially learn from them and also do kind of like their grunt work. It's like an apprenticeship, basically. But your school was like a non-traditional art school, right?
Yes, and it is actually pretty close to an atelier, which I didn't actually know that term until you brought it up, like just before this. I knew actually about. I probably knew it, but forgot it because I knew about that concept, but I didn't know the name for it. Because we weren't necessarily doing work that the master was like then selling, or like we weren't putting the master's name on it, like that kind of stuff, but almost everything else about it was the same. Like there was really one head of the school, his name was Roger Barcelone, And he like taught us all the traditional medium stuff. And it was like a bunch of students all in like this studio together. It was 9 to 5, 5 days a week. All that's like all we there weren't like math classes and English classes and like all that stuff. It was just vocational training. He would give you assignments. He would like actually like hand you the reference photo and be like, paint this. This is what you're working on. And then like would come up behind you and guide you and give you instruction and kind of make his way around the room. And like the first half of the day, he was in there with us. And then the second half of the day, we were working on our own, without his guidance. And then he'd come back in the next day. Every day started with like an hour or an hour and a half of sketching. We had to like pose for each other as like live models for like it. Like it would start. I can't remember. Actually, I think it would start short and then would go long. I can't, or it was flipped. I think it was short then long.
Yeah,
But it
that's
would be
usually how it
like
goes.
minute, yeah, minute gesture sketches, then going into like a 10 or 15 minute like long pose. And then we would work on our whatever our assignment was.
That's
And
very
then in
prescriptive,
the
though.
Yes. Yeah. In the first year, you could only work in pencil. You had to learn.
Oh.
Yeah, you had to like
Whoa.
learn tonality and like shading and like how to photo. It was all like about like photorealism,
Interesting.
off of references. Yeah, and so you had to learn how to be able to like mimic as close to reality as possible in pencil. In a very specific, like this is the technique you're working in. There's no like varying techniques. And then after he felt like you had mastered that, you graduated to color. And then it was like a limited color palette and then a full color palette. And it would be like starting on still lifes, then moving to people and then to landscapes. It was like very like prescriptive. Yeah.
Yeah, I
There
went to a
was like a
somewhat
course.
traditional school and we had sort of like the first foundational year was just black and white. No color for anything,
Yeah.
but you could use a lot of different mediums and it was much less
Oh,
prescriptive, I
that's
think.
cool.
So I think that is like a very traditional like stepping stone manner. And there's a school in New York that does a very similar thing and there's a lot of like Russian schools for
Oh,
painting that
interesting.
do
Yeah.
this. It's very that realism of
Yeah.
like figure models and this like perfectly rendered drawings and
Yeah.
paintings.
Yeah, and that and like actually my stuff from school, because like I feel like the gender portrait series, which is like probably what you're the most familiar with from me, is like it's photorealistic, but it's still like a little bit abstract. I'm exaggerating colors, I'm like leaving in a lot of brush strokes, but like my schoolwork was very like you don't let people see the brush strokes. You have to make it look as close to a photo as possible.
Oh, that bothers me. But I understand
Yeah.
the teaching tool, the learning tool that is beneficial in that sense, but that's maybe taking it a little too far. Do you feel like that was, are you glad that you had that experience, or do you wish you had a less prescriptive experience, a more open-ended traditional art school style experience?
Man, I ask myself that question all the time, and I'm
Or
not sure
none
if
at
I know the
all.
answer.
Do you wish you'd like didn't do any of
Yeah,
it?
no, I'm glad I went to art school. I needed to. I honestly, you also couldn't have convinced me otherwise as a teen. I knew beyond a shadow of doubt I was going to be an artist, even if that meant that I had to be like unemployed and unhoused and just like painting on the side of the road. I would like say that as a teen. I was like very convinced that like it was my destiny. And so there was no way I wasn't going to art school, but I do sometimes wish I had gone to more of a university with like a well-rounded education and also gotten, 'cause there's blind spots in this school. Like on one hand, I am so grateful because they taught me how to paint in a way that I don't know if I would have learned otherwise. And I am glad that I have this technical prowess that allows me to create certain things. However, it also created crutches and roadblocks. It's harder for me to work from my head, and it's like not
Same.
even in a like it not even in just like a can I make it, but more in like a fear standpoint. Like my
Yes.
brain doesn't want to work that way, and I'm like,
Same.
I'm convinced that it's not going to be good. So I
Absolutely.
start pulling out references.
If I have to like change the position of an arm or something in a painting or like change stuff around, I'm like, oh my God, it's gonna look so. Everyone's gonna notice.
And I do think that there's something to it too, because like there's when you're working entirely from your head and you're making up the lighting tends to look a bit like stylized. You know, it's not there, but then when you're working from a reference, you start really actually doing true to life lighting. And like so shadows start falling in very subtle ways. And then when you start changing things, unless you're incredibly good at understanding how that would subtly change all the shadows, you can end up in this weird uncanny valley area where it looks a little too realistic, except in this area where you change something and then it looks like slightly unrealistic. And I think also if you run into that a couple times, then that kind of reinforces the fear and you kind of just, I do feel like I have a lot of roadblocks I put in front of my path that makes art harder to do than it used to be.
Are you doing a lot of painting? Well, actually, let's go back and I want to talk about your how I became familiar with you. This is probably 2015, maybe. Your gender portrait series, I remember the original Kickstarter, and I think I was like
That's
just
2014
graduated
then.
art school, or like I was like early 20s, and I was like, oh my God, there is like another trans woman doing figure painting, and you were like literally the only other one that I knew of, and kind of still, honestly, it's a very niche identity within that field.
Yeah, and it's interesting too because talking later, we found out that we kind of did that for each other because I remember I was working pretty early days on that work. The kick like after the Kickstarter was for a project that I did called Gender Portraits, for those who don't know, and it was a kind of like documentary style series where I was like interviewing the people I was painting so that I was like releasing written stories about them at the same time as painting them. And it was supposed to just be exploring gender at large. So I was painting trans people, intersex people, drag performers, just cisgender, gender non-conforming folks, like kind of trying to get like a wide angle view of gender through these subjects. And I remember it was early days of working on that, and I saw your work. I can't even remember how I found it, but I was obsessed, and it was also that feeling of like, oh my God, there's this other person that's just like me doing very similar work, and I felt like your work was very impressive and inspiring, and I was like holding it up in my head as an example of like, I want to do something like that, like as good as that.
I don't think I knew
And
that. I don't think you ever,
really?
or
Oh,
somehow I forget. I
I.
have the worst memory, so maybe you did like a
So.
long time ago. Because the first time I went to,
It would have
actually,
been.
hold on, no, I won't go into that yet. Continue with gender
Okay.
portraits. Do
I
you feel
also have
like,
the urge to jump forward because I think I know what you're about to say. And, like, yeah.
how do you feel like that series went? Do you feel like it solidified your public persona or your the style that people recognize you from or the work that people recognize you from?
Yeah, honestly, to the point that like I even feel I felt a bit typecast by it, because I feel like I've learned a lot since then about like my taste in art. And like what I like, I feel like now if I did the same thing, like I just don't think I would do the same thing now. I would, I have like a different, I would have done it differently. But also it's hard to separate it because at the time I made it, you know, I came up with the idea in 2013. And at the time I was doing that, the like trans movement was in such a different place and trans visibility. Yeah.
Sure was.
In such a different place. And so, like, doing what I was doing felt incredibly radical and, like, revolutionary. Just, like, painting gender nonconforming people, like, and telling their stories. That felt like a crazy idea to me.
It's also, I feel like, important for people to have the context of, like, that just did not exist.
Yeah.
It just didn't actually exist by done by a trans person. It was always like this gross cis-gazy thing if it had been done at all. And it just truly did not.
Yes, yes. And I mean, that's really why I did it too. It was out of loneliness because I didn't have a lot of community at the time. Not for a lack of trying and searching. It was out of frustration because when I would try to talk to, like, I was like, I had been like slowly coming out over the period of like 3 years at that point. And the conversations I would have with people weren't going well because people had such a lack of like a basis for the language and the concepts. And I felt like I was having to explain every tiny little thing. And so part of it, what I was doing also was trying to create almost like that conversation in a body of work so that I could like cut it out, like so that maybe I wouldn't have to do it in person so much, which is ironic thinking about it because what it ended up doing was it became a career where then I was showing my work and talking about it in standing in a gallery while a bunch of cis people came up to me and had those beginning conversations with me every single art show I did for hours. And I became a professional having that conversation person, which, so that backfired, but.
Yes, you instantly do become a spokesperson, even if it's like.
Yes.
Oh yeah, it's exhausting. People just are. And people have the best intentions. People don't ever usually have bad intentions. They just want to know more, but it like, oh my God, it becomes exhausting.
Yeah. And I think in the beginning, I had like a passion for it. Like I was like, I took it with pride because it was like, I am educating and I am creating. I'm doing this work so that maybe someone else's life is easier. I am doing this work so that the public opinion shifts and public knowledge grows. And it felt like like a calling and it felt like wonderful, but then you do it for a few years and it becomes exhausting. And I started also being in this place where I was like, I feel like when you come out, there's like a period of time where like your whole identity is around gender and queerness and like all these things, and then like it starts to no longer be extraordinary or novel, and you, especially once you find community, and then you're like, now I just kind of want to live my life. And it was hard to move to that point because I was a professional trans.
Yeah, I feel like that like 2 or 3 year mark of like being out and you know, fully having that experience where it no longer becomes novel or new in major ways, like, you chill the fuck out. Like,
yeah.
That's how I describe it. I was like, I was so not chill for the first 2 years.
No.
And I had too many fucking opinions that I shouldn't have been saying.
Yes.
I needed to just chill.
100%. Yeah. 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 Like, I definitely, like, if I were to meet the like past me, I definitely just kind of want to like reach over and turn her volume down a little bit.
Yeah. I just listened to a recording of me when I was 23, and I was so insufferable. I don't know how anybody put up with me. It is very hard to listen to.
Yeah, and you know, and I also think that, like, I mean, I think that that's true also just hearing yourself, like, right? Because especially because you've grown and, like, because, and I do tell myself, try to tell myself, like, in the context of the time, I think it was applicable. But I also think the context of the time is also what made it hard to deal with later, too, because, like, some of the exhaustion also came from the fact that in 2019, for example, the world had changed, and like having those 101 kind of this is what gender is conversations with like 100 cis people lined up for my show no longer felt good, because it was like, you have a million resources. Go watch like a Netflix special. Go Google this. Yeah. Like, there's so many resources at your hands, and there's so like many. Go watch Pose. Like, I don't know. Like none of that stuff existed when I started this project, and it now feels like what I think I wanted from it was like, oh great, all these other people are doing this work too. Now we can maybe move on and do more interesting conversations. I wanted to then move on to like the 201 and the 301 conversations, but I found that people weren't, they still weren't ready for it in a lot of ways. Yeah, also just that there, I had gotten community at that point, and I had started also wanting to make the art more for community and for, because like it had always been kind of both. It was like, I wanted to make it for myself and people like me, and I wanted to make it for the larger world to help educate them. But I felt like the larger world to educate them is always a hungry monster that will take over. And I was like really wanting to be like, I want to say goodbye to you and only make stuff for my community, because I don't.
Yeah.
You're never going to be full.
You're not making it with the intention that it's going to be viewed by cis people. Like, that is not the primary audience. And I think that is such an important shift. And I had that shift as well. And it was like very hard to deprogram that.
Yes. I still find myself like, yeah, I think, because I think that you don't get to the point of being an out queer person or an out trans person without spending a lot of your time censoring yourself and like modifying yourself so that you can survive to that point.
Mm-hmm. And I think especially in your environment too, which let's lead into also how you kind of shot yourself in the foot with that by starting Gender Unbound, which what is a trans and intersex art festival originally in Austin, Texas, which I think the location too of where you were probably also had a big impact, because you were in a very conservative state and times were a bit different. I don't know, both better and for worse. And that is how we first met and first started talking. And it was such a genuinely amazing experience. And I cherished every time I went there, and it was so impactful for me. But I want to hear you talk about why and how you started Gender Unbound.
Yeah. So I had been, so it started, you know, it started with, as an evolution of gender portraits. Like, I was just starting to meet other like trans and intersex artists, and that there was just that growing feeling of like, oh my god, I'm not the only one doing this. I was also starting to grow frustrated with the types of places I could show my work, because I was noticing that like more, I don't know what you'd call it, like high society galleries and spaces weren't very interested in what I was doing.
Very highbrow stuffy.
Yeah. And I felt like at Pride events, people weren't expecting fine art, you know, like, and at art markets, people weren't expecting to have such deep conversations. Like, I felt like everywhere I was at, I didn't fully fit. And I was really kind of wanting to gather more trans and intersex artists and create our own spaces. And so I had in the past, and I also, not gonna lie, I was struggling with money. It's hard to make a living as an artist, and it wasn't, I was getting, like, I was a working food service, you know, to supplement, and I was getting a bit, I was just trying to make what I was doing more sustainable. And I thought, like, okay, if I build a larger organization around this, like, maybe I can leave food service behind and shift my work into organizing these community spaces, like these art spaces, and maybe that can supplement my income instead. So it's still like adjacent to what I'm doing and helping fuel it better. So in the past, I had worked for a nonprofit theater company in Austin called Punchkin Repertory Theater. And I was one of their working board members. And they were a sponsored project of a organization called Austin Creative Alliance, which basically what they did is they were a 501c3 that like artists could apply to become sponsored projects by them, and they would get to use their nonprofit status to apply for grants. And there were like city grants that would help you fund you to like do bigger events. And so like, I knew about that whole program. And so I was like, that's my path to like making that kind of like artist collective, creating their own spaces a reality. And so that's what I did. I became a sponsored project of the Austin Creative Alliance. And around the time that I did that and like applied for my first city grant, I just met this huge group of like trans artists through another community event called Je ne sais queer. And they kind of became a lot of the founding members of that group, and some, like many of them are still actually organizing Gender Unbound to this day. And we started organizing for our first festival, because I don't tend to do small things. I don't know why I thought I couldn't just start with like a little art market or something. I think
you went for it.
I did. I think that part of it's imposter syndrome. Like, I get afraid that if I don't go big, people won't give me the money for it, or people won't show up, or people won't sign on.
I mean, I think there's truth to that.
Yeah, and I think that, I don't know if that's a lesson, how I learned that lesson along my life, but it's something that I really struggle with, and I've been trying to unlearn a bit because I get in my own way. I also end up, I mean, you know, it's weird to say, because like I get in my own way in the fact that it causes me a lot of stress and anxiety, and I maybe could have done the same thing in a more sustainable way. But also, I did it, and it happened, so that's cool.
And yeah, you sure did it. And it's very admirable. I admire you so much because you have, because I also value community organization, and I have done that myself, but not nearly to the scale. So I know how hard it is, and how many little pieces and factors there are to make something go successfully.
Yeah.
And I always admired that you were so good at it and good at managing that, and did such an amazing job of bringing so many people together. I think it's so valuable.
There's something you said in there of like, you know how many little things go into it. And I now know that. And I think one of the other reasons I went so big in the beginning is at the time I didn't. I think if I had known then what I know now, that's part of like what I would have done things very differently, because I didn't realize what all goes into community organizing. And I also want to take a moment to say, like, in that moment that, like, first of all, thank you. That was such sweet and lovely praise. But I was also very lucky to have some really incredible people around me that either I felt like raised the bar and like asked for certain things, or brought knowledge to the table or also were like the banner holders of some of the community stuff.
It really takes a village.
It does. It does. And, you know, if it had just been the Drew Riley show, I think the events would have not grown into what they became. Like, if you basically just go to the Gender Unbounce website and look at the team page and, like, look at also the alumni section, like, all of those people really played such a big part in shaping what the organization became. And at this point, now I've now live in Oregon and not Austin, Texas. And there, I still am an advisor and I'm on the board and I sit down on meetings so that I can answer questions and provide help, but I don't organize the day to day. And it beautifully lives on outside of me, which is cool to have an idea that you come up with turn into a tangible thing that lives on beyond you. That's a neat.
Yeah. I think that also speaks to your leadership skills, though. How does it live on now, in like what capacity?
Well, okay. Before I answer that question, I wanted to talk about your first joining the festival, because that was, so the very first year, 2016, also for context in Texas, because you brought that up earlier, 2016, I believe, was the first year that they started doing all the anti-trans bathroom bills in the state. So
yeah, it was really when things were ramping up.
Yes, yeah, it had gone from like, oh my gosh, look, like trans issues are in the news and like there are shows being made, to oh no, there's a big backlash. Texas was definitely at the forefront of that, and so that had happened earlier that year. And the first festival was mostly local artists and performers, with a few folks coming in from Houston. So like it was almost all statewide except for you. And I reached out to you specifically and asked if you would come, just because I had been a fan and because of that past story of like you being this person who I had watched. And I had it in my head that I wanted it to become bigger than just like a local showcase. And like, I think you were my first, like, it was like, I honestly thought of you like in that like big celebrity status of like, oh, she's going to say no, but I have to reach out. Cause I made you a big deal in my head.
And then you realized I was a fucking idiot.
No, not at all. Yeah, when you said yes, I was like, oh no, this actually has to be good. I was like, it actually like was a big motivator for me to be like, this event can't fall flat on its face. I am like, Kat Graffin's coming. So like, I need to make sure that this is good. So I just wanted to throw that context in there.
You are, my head does not need to get any bigger. You are.
Yeah, I think it was like 13 art, gosh, I actually shouldn't be guessing, it's been too long, I don't remember, but it was like under 20 artists, I believe, and like performers, but like a lot, like it was in this one of those like spaces where during the day it's like a yoga studio and then it's also like a co-working space, like in those like mixed use spaces that we like rented out the whole, yeah, it was funky. It was like most of it was like upstairs, and so it was like in a house, and the attendance, it was like shoulder room, like shoulder to shoulder, standing room only in that space. It was a little overwhelming how many people showed up that first year.
I was like, I had no idea what to expect, and I was like so impressed by how many people showed up. It was like a lot of people.
It was jarring enough that like as an organizer, I got a little scared, because I was like, I don't think we have enough stuff. There's not enough space. The AC was like breaking because it couldn't handle the body heat. It was everyone was sweating because it's.
I remember that
it was September in Texas or August in Texas, somewhere like that. It doesn't matter. It was not December or January or February, which are the only months that Texas is ever cool. So it was hot. Yeah, and so then going forward, each year, A, you came out, which is amazing, but also each year we added days to the festival. It was just one night time. And then I think it was two nights, and then three, and then I think our last year we did actually like a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then we had like a Wednesday film night, like a film only showing. And so yeah, that was that last year was four days. And now I've forgotten what the question that you asked me.
Numbers are?
I would have to go back to our paperwork. I feel like the first year it was like 300 people-ish. But we're
also doesn't sound like 300 doesn't sound like that much when you just like are like, oh, that's not even, that's a small concert. But it's also like, okay, imagine you are trying to plan your family's Thanksgiving, but your family's Thanksgiving is 300 people. Like, that's how daunting it is.
And, like, I honestly, the venue wasn't set up for 300 people. Like, it was like a 50 to 100 people over the course of the night kind of a venue. And so 300 people were jamming in the space. That was the other thing, is they weren't leaving. Like, people were coming and just staying.
Horrible. Why would they do that?
It was great, but it was also like there's too many bodies. It was 300 people like at once, and not like, because I feel like in the later years, I kind of always expected it, the attendance to be a bit more like a linear progression, and it wasn't. It kind of like plateaued at around, I'd say like about 500 people. My memory is a little fuzzy on this, but one of the things that happens was it was longer. It was like people were coming and going, and so it would be more like, you know, like it was more manageable. It was like 100 people at a time generally, and people would come and they'd go. It was also like all day long, instead of, I think that first one was only like maybe 4 hours or something like that. And then now these are like full day events over multiple days, and so it was interesting because like the numbers were going up, but it actually felt like less attended in a way, just because it was not, people weren't crammed in like sardines, which it was much more, much more manageable from an event organizer's standpoint. In the vein of, we didn't do anything sustainable. We never charged artists to attend. We often paid as many people as we could instead. There was no application fee for the festival. Like we were really trying to do things differently than a lot of other exhibitions, like group exhibitions and festivals were doing. Tabling was always free. We had a scholarship like fund kind of a thing. It wasn't a scholarship, but you know, like a fund that people could apply to for financial assistance for traveling if they were out of state. We would try to organize like people who would kind of like donate like a room or a couch if people needed a place to stay. Because, you know, we are, you know, creating a margin, like work for marginalized communities that are disenfranchised. And so we wanted that not to be a barrier as much as possible.
My original question, I remembered what it was. And that was, how does it live on now after 2019?
Oh, yeah. So we had actually already been talking as a group in 2019 because it was the festival was growing and it was beautiful, but it was also it wasn't sustainable. It was starting to become apparent to all of us that it wasn't sustainable, especially as a lot of our organizers were a lot of our organizers were are you know we were all younger, and as people were getting older, people were going off to like continued education and we had somebody who was going to seminary school, and we had some like people that were like now really heavily involved with multiple organizations, and so people were their time was getting stretched, and I was the only person that was full time trying to do every like pick up like all the other little pieces, and I was also realizing that I couldn't keep doing that forever, especially since it wasn't sustaining me financially. And so we were talking about how 2020 was going to be our big, it was going to be our 5th year. It was going to be a big blowout. We're going to make it as awesome as possible, and it was going to be a like goodbye to the huge festival. We're going to be trying to do more sustainable, smaller scale events. And then obviously 2020 laughed in our face, and we didn't get our big blowout goodbye festival. We instead did like a virtual festival, which I think also just really solidified in our hearts that part was done, because for anyone listening who has done virtual programming, especially after doing in-person programming and switching to virtual, it is like all of the work, if not more work, and with like less of the payoff and like
Yeah, and you don't
none of the
feel the
reason.
payoff.
Yeah, you can't see the joy on people's faces. All you get is like a little analytics number of like how many people tuned in for how long. It's really abstract. And also like a big part of why we did everything was to create physical community space where people could like go feel safe, be wowed by people just like them on stage, let loose a little bit. In like the comfort of like 4 walls separating from the outside scary world, and like that's not hap like it's not the same when you're just watching
Yeah.
a live stream of some artists.
I remember having a feeling, it just came to me that I remembered that after the first Gender Unbound, I was like, oh my God, I have never been in a room with more than probably a handful of trans people before. I'd never been in a room. I did not know there were not people I could connect with or meet with or be in share a space with. And that was like so it's hard to explain that it's like relaxing, like you just feel like you are in good company that understands you, and it feels like community, even if it's, just for a short little bit.
Yeah, I mean, there were so many moments where I would just stop, like take a second from like the hesitancy of like trying to make sure everything was going smoothly, and I would just like I would be like moved to tears, because it really was not an experience like since it, I haven't had experiences of like that magnitude of just like especially
Oh, I
in near
don't say
the
that.
like near the last few where it had gotten like into
That's
that
such a sad
big
realization.
space. Yeah, it is. I mean, I will say that. Like, yeah, that's the part that I struggle with, 'cause I don't think we were wrong to be like, this isn't sustainable. And it wasn't. And I was getting panic attacks. I was getting like every year I had like about a month of just panic attacks, because it was just too much to handle. But and I'm glad that I don't feel that amount of stress anymore. But man, there are times where I'm like, maybe I could just do it again. Maybe I should just do it again because I really miss it.
So what are you, how does it live on currently?
Before, and I guess actually, I don't know how much you knew about what Gender Unbound did outside of the festival, because like the festival is the big thing, but throughout the year we did like a Trans Day of Visibility, we did like Intersex Awareness Day stuff, we did just like a winter art market, and those were like smaller scale events where we would have like some comedian like trans and intersex comedians or musicians and have like a few tabling artists. It was local, it was low budget. They're very beautiful, and in they were also very well attended. They started with a Trans Day of Visibility, and it was like an art market and community picnic. And I got to see live streams and photos from it, and I like immediately was crying. It was absolutely beautiful, and they had this outstanding turnout. They had this big outdoor space with this huge lawn with, if you've never been to Austin, we've got a lot of like the trees are really short, but they're wide. And so these like wide sprawling oak trees, and people are just like lounging under them with like blankets and like food that they brought, and they're playing games. And there were just like so many people just being so outwardly trans and just celebratory, and evidently like other organizations knew about it, and so there were like a couple organizations like holding meetings there. They were like, let's do our meeting, but let's do it at the community gathering. And
I love that.
I just it was right. And so that's all they did that year. But it was kind of like a proof that like we could return and that we could also like be sustainable. This year they are doing it again. I think they just started announcing the marketing. So if you're hearing this and you live in Texas and want to make the journey to go see it, check out either genderunbound.org or genderunbound via like Facebook, Instagram, those things. It's just really beautiful to see them like creating it again, and that like there's still so much need for it and so much
Definitely.
that can be done. Yeah,
It's
I
almost
love
like a
it.
different kind of need. I mean, it's the same, but like for different reasons, I would say. Because it's just the political landscape is so cr fucking crazy. And there's a lot more visibility and representation, but there's also this huge, intense backlash that what I feel like wasn't even, ramped up starting in 2016 or earlier, and then just is in full effect.
Yeah, especially right now in Texas, it like if you're under 18 and trans, you cannot get health care. I have dear friends that have had to flee the state. I have and other people who are staying but having to get health care across state lines. And it's not just that they can't get hormones, like doctors won't see them because the doctors are so afraid of lawsuits or being accused of something. Like, it's a scary time. And so, yeah, for those reasons, I do think it's a desperate need. But I even think to zoom out a bit, like, it's a desperate need anyway. Like, I think that what these, I say smaller events, but they still have huge turnouts, which just shows how desperate people are for it. But, like, what is held in them is basically the exact same thing that the festival did. It's just that the festival did it on steroids and did it on a larger scale than locally. But the truth is, like, I'm living in Eugene, Oregon, and I can't go and find a room full of people like me easily. There's not a huge thriving community. There's not like, and if there is, it's different. A lot of times it's like support groups. Like a lot of socials are just built around like you kind of like it's more support oriented, or like maybe there'll be like a free trans yoga in the park kind of a thing, or like come play video games at the local gay bar, you know. But it's not like, come to this place where there's music and comedians and art and like food and drink, and people are just living in the joy of community. And I think that there is a thing that happens to a community when the only time they gather is for resources and support and Trans Day of Remembrance, which is mourning our dead.
Joy.
You know, like those. Yeah. And you start to internalize that and think that like maybe being trans is suffering, or maybe like having trans friends just means listening to their struggles. Like, you don't get this feeling of like, what does it look like to celebrate the life of being trans? And that's something that I think that is desperately needed no matter where you are. And I'm finding that I'm deeply missing it, being away from it.
Yeah. Luckily, I feel like it's very different here in Maine, where because it's so small and there's mm-hmm. so few people, like, it's easier to come together in a way, because like there's a more like collective mindset. I think that goes across Maine in general, where it's like you're so kind of isolated and secluded, you kind of have to find that. And there's the Maine Trans Network, which does incredible stuff here in the state and does so many cool fun things for trans youth. And like all of the volunteers, I've done a little bit of volunteering and I plan to do more for the youth program. Everyone is so dedicated and the kids are like thriving, and like there's a Discord where I'm like a moderator, and there's like 50 just trans kids just like hanging out. And you know, they're horrible because they're teenagers, but they're like, it's just so great to see that. And know that like they have support, and it's not just about like trying to survive. It's deeper and more expansive than that, and it's so necessary. And it's so vital, especially when you don't have a lot of like social connections when you like move somewhere.
Yes.
I want to ask you,
okay,
what advice would you give for anybody that wants to do community organizing, especially around sort of marginalized communities?
Okay. I would say don't do it alone. And I would say try to be kind to yourself and be sustainable through it, because I think that sometimes when people start organizing, there's usually a deep passion there. Like you're feeling like what you're doing is vital, and so therefore you will often sacrifice too much of yourself in the process. But you need something that I think is a good framing to help combat that is to remember that you are also part of the community that you are serving. And so if your goal is to make life for like trans people better, life for queer people better, you know, life for insert your community here better, that also means that your life needs to be good and that you need to be healthy and happy.
I really like
that. Yeah.
I never even thought about that, and honestly.
It's hard. It's like, honestly, I can't take credit. I wish I could remember who told me that. I feel like my team tells me that a lot.
Wow. That's like one of those little things that's like a very small little shift in your thinking. Similar to like what we were talking about with like not making art for the cis gaze. It's just like this very tiny little switch, but it's impactful in the way that you like go about your actions. Like it frames it. Because whenever I've done community stuff, I never, I was like, oh, I'm providing this service for other people. Mm-hmm. And it's not and, also yeah. for myself. I'm not also yeah. part of this. I am the one providing it for other people. Even yeah. though it's all for the same community that I am, in fact, in.
Yes.
And I think that, yeah, that's a really interesting positive mindset. I really like that. Can you hear my dog snoring?
Oh, you've got a dog snoring? Oh, I hear it. Oh, that's cute. I love
it. Okay. Just that it's not coming. It's not the audio. The microphone isn't picking it up for me.
That's great. I mean, I especially, like, I feel like, because what I was about to say, I was about to talk about how bad burnout can be. And I love that we just took a break to listen to a dog snore.
Are you burnt out on art right now?
I'm actually, I feel like I'm starting to come to the other side of some really bad burnout. And I think that is mm-hmm. like another word of warning to people is that when you do hit burnout, it can be extreme and it can be long lasting. Burnout is a very hard thing to recover from once you are in it. And it is easier. Well, I don't know if it's easier, but it's avoiding it. If you can take steps to avoid it, you're going to be in a better position than you will be recovering from it. Because life doesn't stop. And
yeah.
And
that only makes it more stressful when you get burnt out.
Yeah. And also, especially if what you're doing is the types of things that normally had been bringing you joy in life, then it's hard because it's like, well, what do I do? Because like, I still miss being creative. I miss, you know, being in community. These are the things that I had trained myself to turn to fill my cup. But right now they're doing the opposite. There's a lot of weird identity stuff built, like, and I think that's another advice I'd give to people is try not to make what you're doing your whole identity, because that also,
yeah,
you start getting really weird existential questions of like, who am I if I'm not organizing, or who am I if I'm not making this specific art? And I've been
so true though.
Yeah. These are things I've been grappling with basically since the pandemic. And
yeah,
also I didn't help that the pandemic is not a great healing time. Like, cause I was experiencing different traumas, even though I wasn't doing the same work. But I've been taking this time. So basically the reason I live in Oregon now is because my wife is going back to school, and she's in grad school now. She's training to become an architect. I'm super proud of her.
You're extremely lovely, very sweet, kind wife.
She's wonderful.
Yeah. Yes, she is.
Yeah, and she's actually somebody who, in earlier conversations, I was talking about really struggling with money. She was the person that was my support network. She definitely paid for most of our groceries and definitely was the one that was like lifting more than her share of the financial burden and not giving me grief about it and allowing me mm-hmm. to follow my dreams. And now it's been feeling really wonderful to have the tables be flipped and have her going to school and yeah. I'm the sole income provider and I'm like helping support her follow her dreams, and so it's been really lovely to get to like help pay her back for that. But it's,
and that's what a good like partnership is about.
It's never
constantly 50-50.
Yeah, and I think that there's this idea that like it'll probably go back and forth a lot of times in our relationship, and you know, we've even had conversations. It's like, once you're making money again, maybe I won't be trying to get the job that pays the best or whatever. I might be taking the job that allows me to maybe be, even be part-time and do art and stuff again. But I have been taking this time to try and not only recover from burnout, but also find the joy in art again, because I think that that's something that's really hard to hold on to when you're a working artist. It's like, yes, getting back to that place that I was in. The thing that made me as a teen be like, my destiny is art and I will do nothing else. Like, that was born from a pure love of art that I don't know if I feel every day anymore. And trying to find it again. And I've been trying to make art more for me and less for other people. I've been trying to make my art a little bit less important, like in the sense of like, it doesn't have to mean something. It doesn't have to like fulfill a purpose. It doesn't have to put food on my table. It doesn't have to do anything other than just be, which is hard. Weirdly hard.
I think literally every single artist that I've talked to, especially even on the podcast, is feels that exact feeling.
Yeah.
It's like so universal of just like, man, it's really hard to continue loving art when you make it your job and you make it like your whole identity, and when you get burnout and it's brutal. And it's very, very challenging to try to fall in love with it again.
Yeah, it is. And it took a lot longer than I thought. I thought I could just step away for a hot spell and find it again. And it's proving to be a much deeper intellectual challenge. And it's... because, like, I also found, I found that, like, once I was doing art full-time and I was expecting it to help put food on the table, I was making different decisions with it.
Oh, absolutely.
And I was, like, really, like, not making the same art that I would have if I had not cared about whether it was selling or loved. I mean, I guess that's, I don't know if I could ever not care if my art is loved. That's hard. But yeah, you know what I mean, like successful, I guess, is a better word.
You're not trying to like make something that either looks or has more marketable content, like,
yeah.
It's not, you want to make something that people will buy prints of, or people want to potentially buy the original, or could get shared easier, or like appeals to a larger audience, or you start making those decisions and it changes your art.
Something I've been doing recently, which is a weird thing for me, is I have been making art and not sharing it with anybody. Not nobody. I will share it with maybe like, you know, my wife or like whoever's in the room, kind of a thing, but I'm not putting it online. And I may at some point put it online, but it really changes how I think about it, and it like brings the art back to this place that I like think about when I was like a kid and I was like just drawing something and hanging it up on the wall in my room, and it was like for me and maybe for my friends, but that's it. And I still find myself as I'm drawing thinking about, if I did put it online, what would be the reaction? Like, I still, it's so hard to deprogram that part of my brain of like, would this trend on Instagram? Like,
It's so
hard. How would I explain it to somebody?
It's that mindset becomes so second nature to, or so part of the art making process is the social media component of it, I'm so glad I finally got away from. Simply just I recommend everybody get a tumor in their spinal cord and then have major spinal surgery and then not be able to paint for a year. And that'll make you really want to make art again, because
Yeah.
I do want to make, I really, I'm
Oh,
actually
wow.
now want to make art because I haven't been able to make it. Physically cannot make it. So I've just been able to do digital art recently. And that's, I can do digital painting and like that's it. Can't do physical painting. It's like too much
Yeah.
on my body.
And it
And
is a very body, like
yes,
you really do need to use a lot of your body to do physical painting.
you don't notice it until you like can't use those muscles anymore. And my physical therapist actually talked about this. She sees it. She sees this kind of issue in like dentists, where like the act of like holding up something and gripping it with your hand and being very precise uses a ton of your
Yes.
muscles in your back, in your shoulder, in your arm, in your neck. Like it uses your whole body. It's crazy. Just something simple as that is like, it's hard on your body and you don't realize it until you can't do it anymore. So
Yeah.
try it.
I made a promise to myself. I was like, when we're in Eugene, I'm not going to start anything. I'm not going to lead anything. I am not going to like I did I was like, I don't even think I'm gonna try to exhibit. I'm gonna like really try to just take a step back and be a participant. I'm just gonna see what's there. And if there's like a cool organization I want to volunteer for, I can volunteer, but I cannot organize. Like if there's, you know, an art group that meets up to draw, I can go and show up as an attendee, but I'm not going to become one of their artists that like table like that's like a representative or something like that. And that's been kind of my like guiding principle while I'm here. I've been almost seeing it as like a vacation, like a 2-year vacation, which is funny because I'm
Sabbatical.
working and I'm ex Yeah, it's a sabbatical. Yeah, I'm like in I'm working in the games industry and I'm exhausted in so many other ways, but it really has gotten to the point where I find myself missing art. And that is something I was really surprised by when it came back. And I find myself daydreaming about art in a way I didn't before. And I'm even a little bit scared to start. Like, I've been dabbling in making some of these ideas, but I'm a little scared as I'm doing it because I'm afraid of losing this feeling. Because right now it
The
feels
yearning.
like the yearning. Yeah, that's a great word for it. Yes. I'm afraid of losing that. I'm like, so I'm trying to be casual. I'm trying like to like just kind of like flirt with art and not like move in with it yet. Just take it on some dates.
Yeah, don't
No
U-Haul it.
commitment.
What's a good note to end on? Well, I think that's actually a positive note to end on, because you are
Yeah.
looking toward the future and feeling good about art and the potential of making it again rather than being in a place where you're sick of making it or you're in burnout. I feel like that's the indicator that you probably are at the end of burnout, is you want to do it again.
Yeah.
So
It definitely feels different.
yeah, and I'm in a similar place. I mean, for different reasons, but I'm in definitely a similar place where I'm
Yeah.
like, yeah, I'm ready to get back in the saddle once I can do it. And it's a good motivator, because and we have like a whole I have surgery next week, and so I
Yeah.
have like this whole physical therapy battle ahead of me.
Ugh.
And I'm like, it's a good motivator, because I'm like, I want to get back to painting,
It
so I'm gonna
sounds,
like get better.
yeah. I'm sorry that you're having to go through such a gauntlet to get to that point, like a physical. Like I wish that you didn't have to go through this ordeal, and you could have
Same.
maybe the end result, but without the actual like trials and tribulations of this medical journey you're on. But
If
A, I
the
hope
Lord can
that.
lead you to it, he can lead you through it.
But yeah, it does sound like a movie. It's like it's I feel like you're like Rocky, like you've got your montage ahead of you of like the physical therapy for the art easel, and like you're gonna have the time where you sit down and you paint again, and it's gonna feel like really gratifying, and then the credits.
Or I'm gonna be terrible at it because I haven't done it in a year. Either one.
No, that's not what's gonna happen. It's not possible. I've seen your work.
Well, it was lovely talking to you. Thank you so much for doing this. Where can people find your work or the most relevant thing that you're doing right now?
The most relevant thing to follow me right now would be on Instagram at Painted Riley, or go to my Linktree. It's that like linktree.ee/PaintedRiley. /DrewRiley. So yeah, linktree.ee/DrewRiley. Because I am in this place where I'm trying not to restrict myself as to where my art takes me. I'm like trying really, I like the Linktree and the Instagram are nice because as I start deciding to share new things, they're malleable and I can push them wherever I want to push them. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited about that.
Well, thank you again for coming on. And it was lovely talking to you.
Thank you. This has been lovely. And I miss having conversations with you. This is
I know
a delight.
You should restart Gender Unbound just so I can come.
Okay, done. I'll make some calls. Just some